Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Friday night's strike on Assad's alleged chemical weapons sites in Syria by the US, France and the UK, and get an assessment of what was achieved in terms of mission accomplished, which Trump triumphantly tweeted out on Saturday. An expert on Syria, James Gelvin, a professor of history at UCLA and author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know, joins us along with the Syrian opposition spokeswoman, Rafif Shujati, the founder and director of Free Syria Foundation. We will discuss the extent to which the military action was largely cosmetic and theatrical in nature, given that empty buildings and bunkers were destroyed. But on the other hand, it does appear that General Mattis won out over the hawks, Trump and Bolton, in limiting the strikes so that no Russians were killed, which, if there had been Russian casualties, a wider war with catastrophic consequences might have ensued. We will also examine the moral blindness of Nikki Haley's threat that the US is locked and loaded if Assad uses chemical weapons again, since Assad is free to bomb hospitals and use barrel bombs and starvation on his people because the U.S. has no policy when it comes to all other aspects of the Syrian war. Then we will speak with veteran investigative journalist Peter Stone about the bombshell story he broke at McClatchy. Mueller has evidence Cohen was in Prague in 2016, confirming part of dossier. He joins us to discuss the significance of the trip by Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, to Prague in the fall of 2016 during the presidential campaign, just after Manafort was fired, to meet with a top Russian official close to Putin and a group of hackers who were reported to have been paid for hacking the DNC and the emails of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager. Then finally, as Americans file their taxes due on Tuesday, we will examine how we are the least taxed amongst the advanced nations, yet feel the most burdened by taxes. The former Chief of Staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at USC and author of We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money, joins us to discuss his article at the Los Angeles Times. Tax policy is a bore until they take your Social Security and Medicare away, and the profligate spending of taxpayer money by Trump and his cabinet, in particular by Scott Pruitt. And joining us now is James Gelvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East and particularly Greater Syria. He is the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. And also joining us is Rafif Shujati, who is with the Syrian Women's Political Movement. She's the founder and director of the Free Syria Foundation. She was also the English spokeswoman for the local coordinating committees in Syria. And she frequently travels to the Middle East, including Syria, and coordinates with other activists to take actions and inform the public about events in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Gelvin and Rafif Shujati.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thank you, Rafif. And James, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So let me begin with you, James. I mentioned in the opening that I thought this attack on Syria by the U.S., France, and the U.K. was largely cosmetic. As far as I know, these buildings were pretty much empty. That's sort of, I guess, the bad news, if you will. The good news is that apparently the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, was able to win the day against Trump and Bolton, who wanted a much more robust attack, if you will. Mattis had tried to talk him out of it, but then Trump tweeted out how our beautiful missiles were coming, and that could have basically locked us into doing something. So what's your understanding about the prelude to this in terms of the hawks versus the doves within the Trump administration?
Well, first of all, let me just say that it's a pretty pathetic day when we have to say that a reasonable voice is quieting those people who would really risk a war, a direct war with Russia at the present time over Syria. That's certainly not in anybody's interest. It's not in our interest. It's not in the Syrian population's interest either. I think that the problem with the attack, the overall problem with the attack, was the Russian angle and the fact that it cannot be used as a, or the attack will not be seen as a deterrent simply because the United States had to carefully calibrate what it was going to do. It had to be a little bit more than the pinprick of 2017 on the one hand, but it couldn't be enough to get the Russians more involved in a confrontation with the United States. In other words, we couldn't target Russians, we couldn't target Russian aircraft, we couldn't target Russian air bases, and so on and so forth. Now, anybody following the Civil War would know full well that the Syrian army is fairly depleted at the present time and is very much dependent upon Russian air power, Russian military, Iranian-backed militias made up of Iranians, Afghans, Pakistanis, et cetera, et cetera. So that by taking on, by actually doing something that would be powerful, would send a powerful message, would be to risk a wider confrontation. And there's one more thing as well, which is by degrading the military that's against the opposition. This is a cruel irony here, because the Assad regime is in the catbird seat at the present time. They are winning this civil war. And by putting them back on their heels, knocking them back on their heels, what very likely would happen would be a prolongation of serious suffering.
Well, I'm sure Rafif has a different opinion because for the longest time we've spoken a lot over the years, Rafif, as this country has been destroyed before our eyes and millions have been displaced and at least 500,000 have died and the country has all but been destroyed. What's your reaction?
Well, let me start by presenting a very Syrian perspective. We don't call this a civil war. We call this a genocidal regime that started by attacking peaceful protests and allowed things to get militarized. So I just want to set the record straight from a Syrian perspective. In terms of the strike, I agree it's just a pinprick, and I believe the Trump administration is at fault for not having a sustainable Syria strategy. And this is much like his predecessor in the Obama administration, who drew red lines but took no action. But again, from a Syrian perspective, if I am hunkered down in a basement waiting for chemical weapons to drop on me and my family, I am elated that somebody did something, that the international community has displayed even a farce of a conscience when we look at the humanitarian situation, when we look at the military situation or the political situation on the ground in Syria. We see that the international community has done little to nothing to stop the killing. And for most Syrians, this is a welcome change.
And James, my understanding is that, first of all, going back to what Rafif said in the beginning, when the people rose up, part of the Arab Spring, which you've written about in your book, The Arab Uprisings, the Syrian military under Assad was ordered to fire on peaceful demonstrators. Many of them didn't want to do that. And then Assad brought in the Iranians, the Revolutionary Guards. And I understand that in many ways they are really in many ways the tail that's wagging the dog, if not the dog that's wagging the tail. Even the Russians are a little uncomfortable that that the Iranians may well have been behind this gas attack. What's your understanding?
Well, I haven't heard that. Before I begin, let me just say that, you know, I fully applaud with Rafi's voice and the actions that she's taken and also the local coordinating committees. I think that, you know, this is something that is extraordinarily important, particularly for those of us in the United States to understand that there have been groups, there still are groups on the ground in Syria that are committed to a democratic Syria in the future, of Syria without Bashar al-Assad. As far as the other things are concerned, I think that at the present time we're really in an endgame scenario, and that's the unfortunate aspect of what's going on in Syria. Nikki Haley, for example, brought up the possibility of restarting the Geneva process. The Geneva process Bringing everybody together, opposition, government, outside players, it's over. And what appears to be going on right now is the efficacy of a very different process that has eliminated the United States, but involves Russia, Iran, and Turkey, all of whom have their own separate interests in Syria as well. The Russians undoubtedly are not completely wedded to Bashar al-Assad, but they are completely wedded to the idea that a regime that might replace Bashar al-Assad is going to have to be pro-Russian, will not be allowed to be within an American or Western orbit, and which means, of course, will not be allowed to have a free and fair future.
And Rafif, when you mentioned that at least something was done, is there anything more that could be done? I mean, do you disagree with what James is saying, that Assad seems to be winning here? And, you know, to put it bluntly, your side has lost.
Well, so there's multiple questions here. I don't necessarily disagree with the good professor, and I thank you, sir, for the shout-out for the LCC and other nonviolent groups on the ground. I want to go back to the question of the political process. The formal opposition and much of the international community has been talking about a political solution to the problem that is Syria. Unfortunately, the major issue is that we do not have a partner with which or with whom to negotiate. The Assad regime has made it extremely clear that they are not going to negotiate themselves out of power. So we want a political solution. We believe that to sustain a future democracy, we need a political solution and a political transition. Unfortunately, the regime that yields chemical weapons, whether by the Russian dog or the Iranian tail, irrelevant. The fact is, it's a regime that does use chemical weapons, that does use barrel bombs and starvation sieges against a civilian population. And that fact tells us that there cannot be a political solution with such a partner. And so, unfortunately, many of us, particularly in the nonviolent community, are starting to feel that there is only a military solution and that the Assad regime needs to be taken out. In terms of collaboration with Russia or relations with Russia in the future, as far as I know, the opposition has not had a problem with maintaining strong ties with Russia or assuring Russia of its continued interest in Syria. The problem is the Assad regime and the apparatus, the security apparatus that surrounds it, and the basic fundamental issue of authoritarianism.
Well, given that the current situation and the trajectory, though, Rafif, what's your sense then of what leverage could be used, given that this was, I think, to be you know, fair, I think it was pretty cosmetic and rather theatrical. I don't know that very much was achieved, but at the least, you know, a marker was laid down on chemical weapons. As I mentioned in the opening, Nikki Haley says we're locked and loaded if they do it again. Well, what about all the other horrors that happen on a daily basis? You know, we don't have a policy. So do we have a post-Assad policy? I mean, who's going to pay for the reconstruction?
Right. So, you know, when Nikki Haley says we're locked and loaded, this doesn't necessarily indicate much more than bluster, at least to me. And it's unfortunate that the administration is using this kind of language, because I think it's argumentative and belligerent without necessarily having teeth. However, I've got to say, going back to the whole concept of the political process and this most recent strike in Syria, what the message is we're willing to strike in the event of chemical weapons. However, barrel bombs, starvation sieges, cluster bombs, and maybe chlorine attacks are permissible. And this is the tragedy in Syria. Everything is permissible except this sarin gas or mustard gas is not. All other means of killing civilians are allowed.
And James Galvin, What do you understand then is going on with Trump and the Russians? Because it seemed that just recently, Trump, when he was doing a stump speech in Ohio, said, we're going to get out of Syria. And that caught a lot of people by surprise, least of all the Kurds, who would be very vulnerable if the U.S. pulled out those 2,000 special forces. And my understanding is that Trump was furious with Assad and with Putin because of this chemical attack, because he'd already signaled that he wanted to get out. And rather than, you know, cooperate with Trump, Assad goes ahead and takes advantage of what he perceives as a weakness on our part. Is that you think, what happened? I don't know what's going on in terms of communications between the two, but these sanctions that have just been levied against Russia apparently crashed the stock exchange in Russia last week. They really are biting, and Nikki Haley's now promising on Monday that there'll be more sanctions coming.
Well, you know, the Trump administration has been very quick to blame Obama and backing away from the red line. We tend to forget, of course, that there wasn't the votes in Congress probably to allow for a passage of a bill that would enable an attack on Syria as a result of that. But if you look actually at the sequencing of events, it's possible to flip what you said on its head, which was that when Trump announced that the 2,000 American troops that are in Syria now will be withdrawn, it's very possible that this was done in a response to that, either Bashar al-Assad saying, okay, game's over, I don't have to worry about the Americans anymore, or actually needling Trump intentionally with this sort of thing, which, of course, Trump is very, very vulnerable to. So I'm not quite sure where this thing is going. When Trump mentioned or tweeted mission accomplished, the problem is that he mistakes a tactical operation for a mission. There is no mission in Syria. There's only a tactical operation and maybe another tactical operation and maybe a third tactical operation. But we have really no Syria policy. It's arguable that at least under Obama, there was a broader Middle East policy that unfortunately got sidetracked through a whole variety of things, the uprisings, what took place in Syria, and what have you. But it's also very likely that the only policy that we have right now in the Middle East in its entirety is that Trump looks around and sees what Obama did and then decides to become the un-Bama, decides to take a totally different tack. So Obama walked away from his red line. Trump, crosses the, Trump attacks when Syria crosses the red line. Trump befriends the very people that Obama alienated, the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Israelis, and so on. So I think that that is the only foundation that we can say is guiding the Trump administration at the present time to just reverse everything that their predecessor had attempted to do.
And Rafif, what do you expect going forward now? Will Assad turn his attention to the last holdout in Idlib?
Absolutely. I think if you look at the forced displacements that have been taking place, how anybody in the opposition, including civilians, have been moved to Idlib, I believe that's going to be the site of the next part of this ongoing genocide. I think we can expect to see more chemical weapons in play. I think we can expect to see what have the weapons that have become normal, the barrel bombs, et cetera, the targeting of hospitals and markets and other civilian structures. I think it's basically a movie that we keep rewinding and playing over and over. And in the end, we're going to continue to talk about a political solution. We're going to continue to talk about strategy or lack of strategy. And I would agree with James. What we have is tactical moves coming out of the United States as opposed to a mature and well-thought-out strategy. And I think we're simply going to see more of the same. It's a tragedy for humanity that this kind of genocide is allowed.
So, James, just a quick last-minute comment, if you will.
You know, I think that unfortunately, in 6 months or 8 months, we're going to view this particular thing as a tempest in a teapot. The big news is stuff that's going on around it. The big news is the fact that, again, we don't have a Middle East strategy, or the fact that 40 innocent civilians died in this chemical attack, which was horrific. 31,000 innocent civilians died in Aleppo during the siege of Aleppo. And Rafif is absolutely right. There were barrel bombs that were used then. There were cluster bombs that were used then. There were incendiary weapons that were used then. And yet the world remains silent.
Rafif, a quick last comment, if you will.
I mean, I don't know that I can add anything more. I appreciate the fact that you're covering it. I wish more media would focus on sort of the irrationality of living in a world where we have near real-time communications and we're watching people get slaughtered. We are literally watching this ongoing atrocity and doing nothing. I don't know what to leave you with, Ian, other than a thank you for trying to put a spotlight on this tragedy.
Well, Rafif Shuiati, I thank you very much for joining us. Again, Rafif is with the Syrian Women's Political Movement. She's the founder and director of the Free Syria Foundation. And James Galvin is a professor of history at UCLA and the author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, did visit Prague.